Housing is essential for a person's ongoing safety and stability. But in Alaska, affordable housing is very hard to find. Builders face hurdles ranging from the cost of transporting building supplies to limited building seasons. And for housing to be truly affordable, it takes more than just low rents or mortgages. You have to account for heating and utilities, too. Today on Hometown Alaska, we're discussing how to make housing affordable statewide. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. Before we hop into what it takes to build affordable housing here, I want to understand from a personal perspective why it matters so much. This is a father who recently bought a home through Habitat for Humanity, an international nonprofit focused on building affordable housing.
My name is Abdelkader Izzeddin.
How long have you lived in Anchorage?
About 9 years.
You are a homeowner through Habitat. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what it was like for you when you first started looking for a home.
So just my first time I want to buy a house. So yeah, I have in my mind to I want to buy a house, but so I don't know how to, I gonna figure out that one. So just my friend when he told me that about the Habitat. So I apply in Habitat. And
why did you want to buy a house?
I want to buy a house because it's house is important everywhere. Yeah, because it's in my background, we raised in a small house. So we like the 7 kids. So, you know, yeah, I have dream when I'm little, like 17 or 19. Yeah, I want to be, I have my own house and it's a little bit bigger. It's important when you have kids too, you have to figure out do you want to buy a house. Yeah, because for the kids, yeah, it's going to be comfortable. There is good, oh, it's a same school every year. You don't need to change address. Yeah, so, yeah, it's after that, so I think it's good for the future for your kids. Yeah, because, you know, we don't know where you're going to live the life. So, you know, when maybe you're going to leave something for your kids. So that's what I did.
You're right. Like, it creates a lot of stability for your family in general.
Yes.
Has having this stable home, how many years have you been in it?
In the Habitat house? It's like 2 months now. Yeah, I'm new. It's a Habitat now. Yeah. Like 2 months, yeah.
Wow. Before the Habitat home, where were you?
Before Habitat House, I live in Manview. Yeah, I just like rent. So, yeah, with cooking light. Yeah, I've been with him like 6 years. Yeah, so I live in same apartment like 6 years with cooking light. So
in the 2 months since you've moved into your home, what has it been like for your family?
Yeah, it's look great. Yeah, kids there is like it, and it's a big house. We have enough room, and yeah, I'm so happy. So, yeah, you know, I make something for my kids. We really like it. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like when you helped build it?
Yeah, when I helped building, yeah, it's a good experience. Yeah, it's a really good. Yeah, because before I don't know how the people is building the house. But yeah, I learn a lot.
Do you feel like more comfortable in case you have to fix something?
Yes. Yeah, I get a lot of skill. Yeah, I think it's everything broke in my house. Yeah, I think I'm gonna fix it.
Is there anything else you would want to tell people, either about Habitat or about being a first-time homeowner?
It's about being a first-time homeowner. So, yeah, anyone is thinking about this being a homeowner, yeah, just go ahead and apply. And I think it's a good, yeah, it's about the Habitat. Yeah, it's a good program. Yeah, yeah, I don't see him any bad from Habitat. Yeah, there is nice, there is respect, there is everything, and there is helpful. Yeah.
There is respect. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, that is respect. You know that it's a special me. Yeah, when I apply, and you know that we so English is not a first language for me. So yeah, that has helped me a lot about the application, and you know that is understanding what's going on for me, and you know.
Abdu and his kids, who you can hear a little bit in the background, were stopping by a home that Habitat staff and volunteers are rehabilitating after a flood. Soon, it will be ready for another family to move in. John Frummer, Habitat's construction manager, is leading the project.
We're at Neighbor Drive, a neighborhood that Habitat started in 2011 and completed in 2016. 23 units and 23 families. Well, 22 families, I guess.
Describe to me what it's like. Like, what are all of these different homes like?
They are very nice. very well built. Very colorful, which of course you can't see, but take my word for it, they're colorful.
Oh, it's striking. Like, there's red houses and greens and blocks of blue. It's a really colorful, welcoming neighborhood.
Yes. And I believe brought up the property value of all the people around too. and very efficient homes. We've got very efficient furnaces and water heaters, and the insulation in the walls is, I believe, about R30 as opposed to R21 would be conventional framed. Triple pane windows, which were a partial donation from one of our local vendors. And very well built homes.
So we're standing in like a living room and in a kitchen. What else is here? Let's walk around a little.
All right. So the laundry room is over there. We got two bedrooms upstairs, including a bathroom, stairs, rear exit.
What's down here?
We got two more bedrooms down here and a garage and some, very good storage area. Big closet right there. Good use of space under the stairs.
Definitely. So it's expensive to build a house in Alaska and in Anchorage.
Of course.
Tell me a little bit about what went into building this house that we're standing in.
Okay, so we work with volunteers. Volunteers do somewhere in the vicinity of 75-ish% of the labor. Contractors have to do the technical stuff, plumbing, mechanical, electrical. And we have contractors that give us an outstanding discount. And our vendors do as well. And across the board, everybody we deal with is great. And at least gives us a discount, and in some cases, full donations.
And is that what helps make this affordable?
It does, yes. Yeah, that makes it doable for us because we do run on donations.
So if you didn't run on donations and didn't have donated both labor and supplies, how much would a unit like this or a neighborhood like this end up costing?
Each unit would be roughly $250,000. Times 23 units.
Because you have all the donations, what do you end up selling them for, or to the Habitat homeowners?
At their cost.
I think we sell them at cost.
Yeah.
And then what we usually do is a house sponsorship is around $100,000.
Okay.
So that's half-ish of the regular cost of a home.
Okay. So you, like, companies sponsor it?
Companies, individuals, we've had multiple individuals in the past year sponsor a full house for $100,000.
So then people who buy these homes can buy them and pay a mortgage that's actually affordable.
Yes, exactly. They're paying a mortgage that's very, very low cost for them. It's within their budget. We're not trying to go way over the top on that because we want these houses to be affordable. We build them in an affordable way so they're affordable, they're energy efficient, and then we're making their loan and their utilities costs overall really affordable for them so they can be here for a really long time.
So let's say you're talking to someone who's never built a house before. You know,
Am
someone
I?
Like me. Yes, yes, you are.
Okay.
Or our listeners. So if you're explaining like what goes into building a house to someone who has no idea, like what are the different things people should think about?
Wow, that is a very tough question because there is a lot. I've always said there's a million pieces in a house and you got to put them all together in the right place. And that, of course, includes every fastener and every board and everything, you know, but there's a lot of pieces in a house and they all got to be right. We're a contractor like everybody else. We have to do all the same inspections. We have to do everything like everybody else. So we get no exceptions because we're a nonprofit and because we're helping families out. We get no exceptions.
So it's not just like when people are thinking about building a house, it's not even just thinking about like the physical construction. You're also thinking about like the permitting and the zoning.
Absolutely. All of it. Everything is exactly the same as far as the end result. All the same inspections, everything is exactly the same. We are a licensed contractor, just like all the rest of the contractors building houses in Alaska or Anchorage. And yeah, we get no exceptions because we're a nonprofit or because we're providing low-income housing.
And so if you were to build these homes, are you importing supplies from outside of Alaska? Like, do you have to do all of that planning and all of those expenses?
Yes. Everything. We do get some significant donations through Habitat International, and most of those come from the lower 48. So all those vendors that help out Habitat International, we have most of those available to us. However, they have to make it to Alaska, and that takes 3 to 24 months. not actually 24, but like 3 months is kind of the minimum, and I've seen it take as long as 9 months for stuff to get here.
And does that add significantly to like costs or scheduling sometimes?
Well, not if you do it right. So yes, it does. For the most part, no. We try to plan ahead as best we can, and we understand those holdups and the time frames involved. And Julia usually is prodding me beforehand and going, hey, we got to be thinking about this. So you know, we work as a team and we all make it happen.
How does building a Habitat house and working with the Habitat process differ from what you did before when you were just building houses on your own as a private contractor?
Oof. it's very different. I wouldn't say it's completely different because the end result really is the same. However, you're bringing whole new aspects to it by working with volunteers, working with donated materials, working with donated labor, donated or discounted contractors. So a lot of times, because maybe we're getting a donation from a contractor, we may not be at the top of their list. So sometimes you got to take stuff like that into account. Generally speaking, that's not the case, but that has been the case in the past. So
to make it all work out, it seems like there's more, maybe a few more logistics that you have to balance.
For sure, yeah. Specifically with volunteers, because when volunteers show up, generally speaking, they have little or no experience with construction. And then depending on what we're actually doing, they may not even be familiar with that practice or what we're exactly doing that day. Say we're hanging drywall. I mean, it happens every day or all the time that somebody shows up and goes, well, I've never hung drywall before, but let's do it, you know, that's why we're here. Me and my staff are here to make sure it gets done properly and make sure that it will pass inspection and safely too. Our biggest, as staff on the job site, our biggest job is teaching, quality control, and safety. So yeah, that's the primary job for me and my staff, is to keep everybody safe and productive and have a good time so they want to come back. So there's a lot of aspects to it that are drastically different, but of course the end result is really the same. Mm-hmm. It's getting a family in a house.
And so it seems like to do that affordably from the Habitat perspective, it's a community effort.
Absolutely. Yeah, we all got to work together.
That was John Frummer from Habitat for Humanity. After a short break, we'll talk about developing affordable housing in rural areas. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. My next guests are Jasmine Boyle with RuralCap and Colleen Duskin with the Association for Alaska Housing Authorities. Thank you both very much for being in here. So I'd love for you each to give a much more in-depth introduction for who you are and what you do. Colleen.
Thank you, Anne. My name is Colleen Duskin, and I have the pleasure of serving as the executive director for the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities. Our members are the 14 regional housing authorities in Alaska and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And we have two core missions. One, we do training and technical assistance to build capacity within Indian Housing Block Grant recipients' housing programs. And we also do education and advocacy for mostly policy issues on the state and national level too. Increase the supply of safe, sanitary, and affordable housing across the state.
What does technical assistance mean?
Technical assistance is where we have people that go into housing programs to help build the capacity of housing providers in our communities. And so that can range from audit prep to financial to admissions and occupancy to building performas for affordable housing. It really runs the gamut in whatever the tribes or housing programs need to be successful in their work.
Very cool. Jasmine, how about you? What is your role?
Well, my name is Jasmine Boyle, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Rural Alaska Community Action Program, most commonly known as RuralCap. We do work and have done work on poverty alleviation across the state for almost 50 years. And our work changes a lot because our work as a community action agency is about responding to changing community needs with a focus on poverty alleviation. So over the years, over the decades, we've done all sorts of work across the state. But our current focuses really look at housing, early education, certainly the work on rural development and rural capacity building in partnership with the many, many stakeholders across rural Alaska. And like Colleen, we do quite a bit of advocacy and education across the state to help illuminate the needs of people because it's different everywhere. And I think the needs around poverty show up differently across the state in different communities. So we have, I think, in our organization, the tremendous privilege and responsibility of trying to highlight and advocate to help get those needs met.
So one of the needs that we see across the state is housing. In fact, we frequently hear about a housing crisis in Alaska. And I was wondering if you could describe what exactly does that mean? What does a housing crisis look like?
Thank you, Anne. In our rural communities, it's really multifaceted, and it really depends on what community you're in, as they vary greatly. But what we see across the state is a lack of units, a lack of affordable housing units. We see overcrowding at a rate that is at least twice the national average. We see homes that were built in the late 70s, early 80s that are dilapidated and need rehabilitation. And so what we see, and when we talk about a housing crisis, it's all of those factors depending on what community you're in. And that results in many different things, one being out-migration, one being, again, overcrowding, and just the lack of units in our communities really is what we would call the housing crisis.
And so when you say overcrowding, that means like large families in a small home, multiple families in a home?
Multiple families in a home. In some communities, as I had mentioned, I think it's 40% of homes in the Bethel area are overcrowded. And that definition changes within HUD itself. But it is, you can see some communities having upwards of 15 to 18 people in 1,100 square feet, where there are people that are sleeping in the kitchen, or people take shifts because the children have to sleep at night so they can go to school in the morning. And then that, of course, just alters the entire family dynamics of and also affects the economic stability of the family. If you're not able to sleep at night, how could you get up and go to work in the morning? So it just really has this multi-layered effect on communities and families.
Thank you for describing that. I think that people don't necessarily understand kind of how this isn't just about physical space. It's about how this physical space affects how you can operate and your overall health and your mental health.
Absolutely. And not only within the family, but then again, the community and the economics of the community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What does it look like? What does a housing crisis look like in an urban area?
Well, it can often look the same when we think about Alaska and what is urban in Alaska. But I think more specifically, if I look at Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, I think many people will have experienced, one, our vacancy rate for rentals has dropped pretty low. I'm told by folks wiser than me that a healthy vacancy rate in apartments is generally around 8%. And last I heard, we were floating around 2%. And if you think about that from a landlord perspective, that means that I can be really discerning and perhaps even very selective in who I choose to rent to. I was very privileged to have a small mother-in-law when I was a single gal, and I rented it out to a lovely college student who I am great friends with. But I was able to be picky because that was a circumstance that lots of folks applied, and I was able to pick someone that felt right for me. But that makes it very hard for our folks that don't have a healthy bank account or lots of savings or perfect rental histories to get into the market. It's also really challenging if you have a larger family. You know, the last time I talked to the lovely folks over at our disability advocacy partners across the state, Access Alaska told me that we had a 3-year wait list in Anchorage for ADA compliant apartments. So if you're an elder with different needs, if you're a person like me living through health complications, and you need a different way to access your microwave or refrigerator or stove, you're on a multi-year wait list in Anchorage with a very low vacancy rate. And Juneau and Fairbanks are experiencing the same. I also hear anecdotally a lot of community members with concerns about Airbnb rentals, also edging people out of their rental units. I've heard a few stories that were just heartbreaking about, you know, folks that had moved on to different stages in their life and then eventually had to give up their apartments because of an Airbnb transition and just couldn't find another apartment rental. I think for a time, people were from Anchorage going to the Valley and looking for more affordable real estate. But when you think about the cost of fuel, the challenges of childcare, you know, working in Anchorage and living in the Valley and having your kids in childcare or in school 45 minutes away isn't feasible for many working parents. And so I think really to underscore what Colleen was saying, we can talk about the housing crisis, but it is absolutely related to the economy and economic circumstances of our state, to childcare availability, to job flexibility and availability, but also the cost of heating. And so one thing that Colleen mentioned that I think is really important is we do not have enough housing in our state. We definitely do not have enough housing that is affordable across the state. In my opinion, that becomes more extreme the further we get off the road system for many obvious reasons, and I think many historical reasons. But even if we can help people access low income qualifying loans, we could theoretically help someone access a mortgage for even as low as $100 a month. But if your heating bill then comes in at $900 a month, what looked like an affordable home very rapidly becomes a home that is not actually functionally affordable. And I think to some degree we see that in Anchorage as well, Fairbanks as well. And I think it goes without saying that the most extreme vision or visual for our community around housing insecurity or housing instability is literal homelessness. And I think there isn't a person in Alaska that hasn't seen a visible change to outdoor homelessness over the last 3 years in particular, which I believe is directly correlated to the economic impacts of COVID and the housing crisis. We just don't have opportunities even for people with a healthy income to move into a rental, let alone pursue what I think is a very common American dream, which is a home for a starter family, a home for an extended family with elders, and the reality that sometimes we have to caregive, but not just any home, a home that is safe, a home that is sizable, and a home that allows you to live and function as a dynamic family.
So looking more closely at what's happening in rural Alaska, and especially because, Colleen, you mentioned that that spills over into urban Alaska because of outmigration from villages, from hub communities. Why? Why is this such a challenge to develop affordable housing in rural areas of Alaska?
Well, I have one kind of comment that dovetails a little bit on what Jasmine was saying, is that our cost of fuel in our communities is sky high. And what the housing authorities, as they're developing homes in our rural communities, they're developing to a standard that helps minimize that. And it's they're built for the family's affordability. Not necessarily, they're not going to use the cheap material and they're not going to use the cut corners to make building affordable. They need it to be affordable for the families. And so they are building six-star homes in our communities to try to mitigate the impacts that high cost of living has in the communities. And so
six energy star.
Yes.
Highest rating. Okay.
A six energy star rating homes. And under, we don't have a building code standard, but they build to that standard under the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation building energy efficiency standard B standards. So anyway, I wanted to dovetail on that. And so to answer the question about stymieing the outmigration in our community and what causes that, again, it's just the high cost of living. Body soap that costs $25 is just outrageous. And heating fuel for $13 a gallon is outrageous. These are things that our communities are dealing with. Kind of coupled on top of that, when you think about the younger generation even moving out of our communities, they're going off to school where they can get higher education. And do they have a place to live when they come back? Or if they want to go back to their communities, is there a place for them to live? Or are they going to stay with mom and dad and kind of compound that overcrowding situation that we talked about already? If they want to go back and be a teacher in their community, is there teacher housing? These are issues that I hear my members talking about in their communities, and how we're partnering with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the state funding for the professional housing that helps with teachers and health professionals and public safety. So I think it's, again, multifaceted of how we help the outmigration, or not help the outmigration, but help stymie the outmigration of our rural communities. And again, that's usually to the hubs, and then again to the larger urban centers.
So if there was housing available, young people could go out, get professional degrees if that's what they need, come back and provide services in their community. But if there's no housing available, it's not a feasible future.
Yes.
So what makes it so hard to develop housing?
It is expensive, and it's a long process. And we have flat funding. Our funding has actually declined by more than 23%. While the overall, when I say our funding, I'm talking about the main pot within HUD is the Indian Housing Block Grant, and that has decreased. Well, it has been flat, but it's really been eroded by inflation by up to 23%, while the larger HUD budget itself has grown by 25%. There's a real inequity there. So that's number one.
So I just want to make sure that people really understand this. So basically, funding for the housing authorities to develop high-quality, energy-efficient housing in rural areas, most of that funding comes from a block grant within HUD,
yeah,
specifically for tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And that chunk of money has not increased despite increasing need, but overall HUD funding has increased, meaning there's even less funding for developing housing in rural areas.
Yes, and we had the first increase last year, so FY22, and that was, but you still have the eaten by erosion over 25 years, and we're not only eaten by inflation, but our construction costs and our shipping costs are astronomical. Like, we hear a 50% increase, which isn't far-fledged, because our brothers and sisters in the lower 48 are seeing like 25%. So we have increased cost. We have flat funding. We have procurement challenges where our housing authorities are required to go out to bid. And the bids are only good for 24 hours, up to 3 days if you're lucky. So you have to have a competitive program. It's mind-boggling. That's not even considering the transportation challenges that we have getting these materials to our communities. Kotzebue's first barge is the beginning of July. Okeavik's first barge is the beginning of August. So you have to winter your materials the year before.
Which costs money to winter your materials.
Yes. So it's like there's a lot of different factors that play into why does housing cost so much in our rural communities? And these are just a snippet of like some of the real-time things that I hear my members are dealing with every day.
And then are there further restrictions on the funding for things like, Jasmine, I remember you mentioned restrictions like you have to have paved roads, which doesn't happen in some villages. I mean, some people, you have to have boardwalks. Roads don't make sense.
I think that it's really important to understand the complicated world of policy and funding around housing enough to say the folks that Colleen gets to work with and represent in this conversation have access to the funding that she described. I think to sidestep just a little into kind of mainstream U.S. funding availability through Housing and Urban Development HUD, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, even low-income mortgage development and loan packaging, or certainly market loan packaging, you know, very traditional for-profit housing development. There's a reason that you don't see housing developers flooding Alaska. We have demand. We have a market. Nobody's building outside of our partners at AHA and around the state who have what I believe is a community commitment. They're building because it's the right thing to do, not because anybody is making a profit margin off of the building. You know, the last I heard from the farthest northern parts of the state, it's almost $1 million a pop to build a home. And what Colleen emphasized earlier about we just can't build minimum housing, even if there's no code. We really have to think about housing that's going to last until the next generation and, again, continue to be affordable functionally. RuralCap was the first organization to start doing weatherization in the state of Alaska. And weatherization to most folks, I think all you really need to understand is it's about taking the existing housing stock and improving safety, air quality, energy efficiency, et cetera, et cetera. Since we started weatherizing, and we are one of three or four organizations outside of the regional housing authorities that has access to doing weatherization through federal Department of Energy funds, we have weatherized almost 40,000 homes, just one organization, almost 40,000 homes, and our wait lists never end. Every time we go to a new village or new community, and we try very hard to do that in partnership with the regional housing authorities, because the shipment, the labor, you know, thinking about the reality that the construction season is so narrow in rural, even for weatherization, and that many of our skilled laborers have subsistence requirements for their family in that same season. So the asking folks to choose, and this is an extreme and not nuanced statement, but asking people to choose, do you want to feed your family this winter or do you want to build homes in your community, is unreasonable. And so even with the more mainstream funding that's available to organizations like mine or to a for-profit organization, we end up hitting those policy barriers. And I think you mentioned one you and I had spoken about. So for example, with weatherization, we have some flexibility. However, those homes in the 70s and 80s were built like California homes. They were not built for our weather. They were not built for our unique heating needs. And there isn't a whole lot of maintenance available in some communities. There are certainly exceptions that are doing very, very well with this. If you kind of flip over to another model that we use at RuralCap is called self-help housing. It's that sweat equity model of if you lean in to help us build your home, you'll not only learn how to manage and be able to care for your home, but you'll have a lower mortgage. You'll have a better affordability. One of the criteria to access funding for that project is, as you mentioned, a paved road. So I can do that work in partnership with the community on the Kenai Peninsula. I could probably do that work just about anywhere on the road system. But when we talk about taking that work to some of the communities that have the greatest need, first thing I run into is those policy challenges. I will also acknowledge that with our current federal administration, there is a tremendous desire to look at altering policy that provides limits and not access. But those things are often multi-year journeys in advocacy and education with our federal partners. I certainly think, and Colleen could speak about it if it's useful, that there has been movement, I think, in the last few years. We had a federal delegation come out to Savonga to talk about overcrowding a few years ago. You know, the Bureau of Indian Affairs co-hosted a summit on the housing and homelessness challenges in rural communities out of Anchorage for the first time a few years ago. So there's little pockets of understanding that our needs in Alaska do not often match federal legislation, whether it's through things like the block grants or whether it's through what I'm going to keep calling mainstream funding this afternoon. But I think when we step back, we're talking about a crisis that's now. And I'll also say we're talking about an opportunity that's now with the 2020 infrastructure bill and the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act. We are seeing investment in water, sewage, energy efficiency, just about everything but housing, because neither of those infrastructure packages had a single dollar for new housing development, some money for weatherization. And I am very grateful that that is coming into the state for our communities in need. But one, it's a bit odd to me to lay water and sewage and not be thinking about the house that should probably be connected to that water and sewage. But that's kind of where I go back to that advocacy. And again, that's a multi-year effort of really helping the feds to understand that what Alaska could use, in addition to many other things, is housing for everyone, regardless of income.
I'd like to add on and emphasize that, yes, housing was left out of these large funding packages. And just what Jasmine said, why are you building water and sewer and you need home? Community is based around home. If there is no home, you don't need that infrastructure. You need homes. And Jasmine is right. There are opportunities for us to change policy. And I wanted to touch on what she had talked about with weatherization. When you think about federal Department of Energy weatherization, for example, the allocation that they give per home wouldn't even cover the shipping barely of that material to get to the community. So we're lucky in Alaska that we have the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the state legislature that appropriates some funding to weatherization, which bumps up that number. So impactful work could be done, because $7,000 for a weatherization project in our communities is not going to even buy your windows and get them out to Savunga or Koktovik, wherever. It's so those are opportunities that we will continue to push. And that's something that we focus on at the association quite a bit. It's like, how do we change policy to fit our communities and better serve our people?
That's one solution, shifting policies. Are there, in the last few minutes we have, are there other solutions that people can look to for, you know, making the situation better in Alaska for housing?
Well, I think one is innovation. And I really think that that's where understanding who the community is and really elevating and making the space to make sure that the conversation starts and ends with the community and what the community needs. I've heard everything from using a blimp to fly Connexes out to rural, to tiny homes, to let's talk about public housing in rural. You know, I hear a lot of ideas. And I do believe that, again, we're in a moment of opportunity. My worry is that we're not coordinating and seizing that opportunity. I think there are many of us who are working on doing that, and I'm very privileged to get to be a part of what Colleen and many others do. But part of it is, I think we need to think of an Alaska solution for Alaskan communities. And again, that gets hard with the money. But also we need to think about not just for today, right? What we probably won't have time to get into is the change in climate, the storm that just hit our coast, and the second storm that just hit the coast a second time. And the reality that we were working with communities where it wasn't one home or one family, it wasn't one family that was displaced when a home was moved by the tide off of its foundation. It was four. And so now we're talking about homelessness in a community where you absolutely cannot have survival and homelessness coexist. And so we put the burden back into overcrowding because communities care about their people and they aren't going to let their people be outside. So when we think about solutions, they have to be solutions that are appropriate for our climate and potential changes. They also have to be solutions that are appropriate for the community. I heard a very wise person in a meeting that Colleen and I were sitting in. You can't take people from Kansas and put them in New England and ask them to fish and expect that to be appropriate for that community and that community's needs. So I also think we need to think about housing that works for that community, the economy in that community, the family dynamics in that community. And I don't think that's going to be a solution from the lower 48. So we have infrastructure money moving. I think we have an interest in partnership and in looking at the expertise that is already in rural in a completely different way with our federal and state partners.
Yeah, and I like that thought process in understanding that innovation is happening in our communities, the tiny homes, the container homes, there are these pockets that we have in our communities that are tried and tested. But again, we're going back to serving a family and making sure that we have sound homes in our community. So there is room for that innovation and the different things that are happening, but understanding that there are people in our communities that are doing that, and it's for the communities, by the communities, they're in the communities and listening to the families.
Having the solutions be locally and community driven and led. Thank you. Thank you both very, very much for being here. I've appreciated our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for covering this topic.
Yes.
That was host Anne Hillman speaking with Jasmine Boyle from RuralCap and Colleen Dushkin from the Association for Alaska Housing Authorities. After this short break, we'll be back with State of Art for a conversation with musician Marion Call about the Alaska Playlist Project. This is Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art on Hometown Alaska, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, we'll hear how a group is working to make Alaska music easier to find and access by compiling playlists of homegrown artists. It's called the Alaska Playlist Project, and I'm joined by Juneau-based singer-songwriter Marion Call to find out more.
I'm with an organization called AKIMI, the Alaska Independent Musicians Initiative, but we're starting a new project called Music Alaska, which is project about elevating Alaska music on the statewide scene and on the global scene. We want Alaskans to be listening to Alaska music, and we want Alaska musicians to have an easier time making music and being heard.
Yeah, so I mean, from your perspective as, you know, a working musician, can you kind of give me some context about, you know, what the grind of a working musician is like, or what that experience has been like for you, and maybe how kind of, you know, some of this broader help or bringing in other musicians could be beneficial to, you know, working musicians like yourself?
Being a working musician is a huge hustle, and it's also a great life. It does involve a lot of music making, yes, sitting around playing instruments, recording, playing shows, but there's also just a tremendous amount of kind of administrative work and, you know, futzing around on Facebook and working with online platforms like CD Baby that collect your royalties for you. You know, there's a lot of kind of grind work to it. And in Alaska, all of this is complicated by the fact that it's a lot harder for most of us to tour than it is for folks in the lower 48. In the lower 48, a normal part of being a working musician might be to hop in your van on the weekend and go play three cities and then come back home, right? In Alaska, some folks can do that, but a lot of us can't, either because the geography is too much of an obstacle, or the money's too much of an obstacle, or just because the populations in the cities we can reach are small enough that it's hard to earn that much money at shows. So yeah, we have some unique challenges in Alaska that make being a working musician a little bit more different here than it is in the rest of the country. Now, I see that as a potential advantage if we can understand our own music ecosystem better and work together, because it's kind of too small of a state for us to really compete with each other. None of us sound exactly the same. None of us is really making exactly the same music. And if we get our heads together, I think that we can make the scene better for everyone.
Yeah. So tell me about the Alaska Playlist Project. So what is it exactly?
Akimi and Music Alaska have been spending a lot of time listening and learning from other music organizations around the world. Some of them are close, like Music Portland or King County Creative or the Texas Music Office. Some are far off. We've got friends at Music Iceland and Music Norway. We're making friends with folks in the Faroe Islands and Greenland who work on music there. And we've been sharing information about how you get a community excited about its own music, right? And the Playlist Project, the Alaska Playlist Project, is where we decided to start. Because Spotify and other platforms where people listen to music don't make it easy to search by geographic region, right? You can't just log on and search for Alaska music. All you're going to find is a bunch of bands from Europe that have named themselves Alaska because they think it sounds cool. And that's really irritating. So we decided we wanted to make it really easy to listen to Alaskan artists. And that started by building playlists. We have built playlists in a bunch of different genres that are all Alaskan artists. We've built playlists on different regions. We have a Fairbanks playlist and a Juneau playlist and an Anchorage playlist. We're working on a Kenai Peninsula playlist right now. We're working on a Southeast Alaska playlist. And that's exciting to me because the artists here are such high quality. Like, you can throw these playlists on in the background and listen to them, you know, during a dinner party or while you're working out or while you're anything. And they're every bit as good as anything being made out of state. In fact, I think they're better. I'm just really proud of the work being done here. And it's just so much easier to listen to Alaska music when it's been thrown on a playlist for you. I used to DJ at KTOO as a volunteer DJ down here in Juneau. And sometimes I would decide, I want to play 2 hours of Alaska music for my show tonight. And the first hour would be easy, right? Because I would program kind of my friends and people I knew. But after that, I would start running out of artists and have to do research. And it could be hours and hours of research to find people who are not only, okay, they're in Alaska, they're making music, here's their record. Now I got to find the song on the record. I got to make sure all the lyrics can be played on the radio. That was many, many hours of work. And we are kind of taking those hours of work that many different people have done and consolidating them into something you can simply summon by looking up Music Alaska on Spotify. That's one word, Music Alaska. And then you can just hit play on any of the playlists. We're releasing new playlists every month, and we are continuing to build the old playlists. So the playlists that exist, most of them are going to get longer. We want them to be 2, 3, 4 hours long and keep changing and keep growing. And we're soliciting ideas for new playlists, too.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, if people want to get involved or submit stuff, they can do that as well. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
I know that music gets clicky in Alaska, especially regionally, and people don't always know what's happening in other pieces of the music scene or in other parts of the state. So we have a website, alaskaplaylistproject.com, with a big old submit button. We are looking for submissions, and we already have about 40. I've been trying to answer all of them in detail. But we are taking those submissions and adding new artists to the playlist. Some of my favorite people on the playlist are folks that are brand new to me that I found through submissions. So I'm really excited about that. I'm hoping we get lots more submissions for new and old artists.
Yeah. And, you know, you kind of talked about some of the benefits being, you know, kind of building this ecosystem, you know, making Alaska music easier to find, you know, like you said, outside of just bands named Alaska or whatever. But like from your perspective as a musician, what would be, you know, some of the other benefits of, you know, putting some of these playlists together?
There's a few benefits to making these playlists. One is it's just good listening. I love it. Another is that in other places that have focused on building their music ecosystem and strengthening it, one of the steps to that is giving people a pride in listening local and a pride in lifting up their local artists and saying, these folks are the people I want to be listening to on a regular basis. One thing that does is make it easier to find new bands that you actually want to go out and hear when they're playing near you. Another part of that is that we train the algorithm to start suggesting Alaskan bands together, right? Like when Quinn Kristofferson gets played on someone's Spotify, I want another Alaskan band to pop up next, right? I want to see that happen. And that will happen if we decide to make the algorithm work for us instead of just exploit us. So training software, training these AI processes to see that our Alaskan bands belong together and that everyone can kind of be lifted up together is going to mean that everyone gets more streams, everyone gets suggested more often. The last part of our vision is that eventually when tourists arrive in town, they're going to be hearing Alaska music on the buses that take them to the glacier. They're going to be hearing Alaska music in gift shops. They're going to be hearing Alaska music all over the place. Just like when you visit a place like Iceland, they prioritize surrounding you with their local art and culture. And for them, that includes music. For us, we have a very strong Made in Alaska visual brand, right? It's important to Alaskans that artwork made here be prioritized over stuff made kind of outside. And we want to see that same pride extended to music so that when people land in Alaska, they're hearing Alaska music on the tour buses and in the gift shops. And even locally, that we take pride in having an Alaska playlist on at the restaurant while we have dinner, right? That's going to happen after we make it easy for businesses to access those playlists. So that's one of the things we're trying to do.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, are there, do you have other kind of concrete plans or stuff in the works to share and utilize these playlists?
Yeah. We develop these playlists together with people who work in public radio. And in Alaska, public and local radio are really still important cultural hubs, especially for musicians. So Lauren Dixon at KNBA and Shelley Delaney down here at KTOO helped us figure out how to make these playlists easy for community DJs to work with as a starting point. So we're sharing these playlists with community DJs who play music all over Alaska so that when they're doing their show, whatever their show is, if it's hip hop or if it's women artists of the world or if it's, you know, jazz, that they can use the playlist as a resource to throw some Alaskans in to their program on a regular basis instead of just folks from outside. So that's one of the first places where we want to connect with the kind of music listening structure of the state. One of the next is to connect with the tourism industry. So we've been partners with Visit Anchorage and Visit Juneau, and the Alaska Travel Industry Association Conference is something that we've prioritized attending to start making it possible for tourism industries to begin thinking of Alaska music as a priority, both live shows and, you know, paying live artists to be in tourism spaces, and now hopefully adding Alaskan background music that they know is appropriate for their venue or their tour, whatever that is, whether it's heliskiing and they want some, like, you know, upbeat metal and hardcore, or if it's, you know, spa day and they want something ambient and relaxing. We want them to be able to find something that is in fact local that is going to work for their business, because it's part of the experience of being here. We want to make that an easy part of the Alaskan experience to share.
So a recent study was done on music and policy looking at three cities, including Juneau. You know, what was that study and what can you tell me about the results?
That was a really cool process to be a part of. Juneau was selected to be part of a comparative three-city study by the Center for Music Ecosystems. That's a nonprofit that studies music in its natural environment. It used to be the Center for Music Economy, but they've transitioned to the Center for Music Ecosystems. I really like that because a lot of important music that happens in our community is not connected to money, but it's still very important. So they did a policy survey and kind of a cultural resources survey of Juneau and of Nuuk, the capital of Greenland, and of Tórshavn, capital of the Faroe Islands. They're kind of similar in size. They're all a little bit remote from the rest of the world. And they are also all important populations with local indigenous languages and local indigenous culture resurgent and on the rise. It was a really exciting study to do. I interviewed a lot of local music leaders, folks that everybody in town knows have been active in the music ecosystem for a long time. We kind of talked big picture, which people don't usually have time to do, not just about their job, like running all the sound for every live event in town or coordinating music education projects. But we talked big picture about the Juneau scene and what we need and what we're good at and what are our strengths, what we wish we could have here, how we could build it. That was a really productive conversation to start. The study is on the dry side. It's very long, but let me tell you, I loved reading it. I'm kind of nerdy about this stuff. It had a lot of recommendations for us that were very specific. Some were policy related, but a lot are things that we could simply just do right now. One of the most important is building the all ages music ecosystem out so that we have places for young people to play that are not in the bars, so that we can build that bridge between, you know, being 12 and getting to the point of being able to start playing an instrument in public to being 21. And I am excited to start that work. It's kind of handy to have this official looking study that can be presented to the assembly, that can be presented to like our local economic development minds and say, look, this study identifies these gaps in the music ecosystem. And if we kind of build these missing ladder rungs, then it's going to help develop the scene for all of us. That does include economic development, but it's not only about economic development. It's also just about our strength as a community.
That was my conversation with Marion Call, Juneau-based musician and part of the Alaska Independent Musician Initiative. She was telling us about the Alaska Playlist Project, an effort to make Alaska music easier to find and access. You can find more information at alaskaplaylistproject.com. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. Earlier in the show, our guests were Abdelkader Azzedine, John Frommer, Jasmine Boyle, and Colleen Dushkin. I'm Ann Hillman. Our producer is Ammon Swenson. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.